All right. Before I begin, I just want to say that we are recording this. So if you do ask a question or talk about anything personal, you can always either say you don't want it to be recorded, or afterwards you could say, please delete that. And I don't know where this recording is going, but I don't think it's going all that far. Another thing about talking about your experiences in meditation is that with a large group like this, it might not feel all that safe or comfortable to go into much detail about what you're thinking about or going through. And I would hope that everybody here would just keep whatever they hear from people confidential, that you wouldn't talk about it outside of this group or after this workshop. And the reason I also say that is an important feature of this way of meditating, what I'm going to be presenting, is addressing what goes on in your meditation practice. So I do give short talks and then open up for questions and things about what's going on in your sittings, and I may give another short talk, and then it just kind of flows in that kind of manner. At some point when I open up for questions, you can, ask me questions about your meditation practice or things that I'm talking about. And just one last thing about that is this approach to teaching may feel like it's goes against what you've been taught by other teachers or traditions and may seem controversial or provocative. So I don't mind questions that are basically disagreeing with what I'm saying. In fact, that actually adds to the dialogue. So perfectly fine with that as well. Just let me give you a little bit of background on the approach, that when I gave you those instructions about bring your attention to your body and allowing your thoughts and feelings into your meditation, the reason for that type of beginning in practice is basically to help develop greater tolerance and gentleness towards your thoughts and emotions when you meditate. That the orientation here is how to become aware of thoughts and emotions. And my new book, which is coming out in the fall, is titled Thoughts Are Not the Enemy. And really, it's a way of looking at thinking in meditation and meditating with your thinking that makes it so that thoughts really aren't the enemy. They're not a problem. It's really how we relate to our thinking, and how we, in a sense, are able to, I believe, actually become more aware of our thinking and explore our thoughts and understand the Dharma teachings from a much, I think, richer, deeper place. So this approach to meditation then begins with a way in which thoughts can be allowed, but you may find that when you were thinking a bit too much or you felt you were going too far in these in certain areas, you had a place to come back to, your body or sometimes sounds or something else that may have helped to ground you for a bit, and then you could go back into the thinking. Now, what happens with the breath often is that the breath is not necessarily a very good grounding place for us, because it's changing, it's shifting. It's a bit like our thoughts that are moving through. And so when you try to bring your attention back to the breath, sometimes you have to go through a few steps. You know, where is my breath? You're noticing the in-breath or the out-breath or something like that. And then you're following the breath and it's moving, and then you're thinking. And I think it's been pretty well known and documented that it's hard to be aware of thinking and the breath at the same time. That's one reason why breath meditation practice may actually bring people into a place where thoughts are as a distraction, because of just the nature of the way we are, you know, our mind, body is such that we may have a hard time just being with, allowing thoughts and breathing, but being with your body, being aware of the contact points of the hands or the feet, you may find that there isn't quite as much conflict between that and sitting with your thoughts. So it's really conducive to a practice of allowing thinking into your sittings. Now, the other feature is the recollection after the sitting. Many times when people meditate, they just get up from a sitting and go and do something else, and often forget what happened during the meditation sitting. So what we're doing here, hold on a minute, is just pausing and reflecting back and getting a sense of really what happened when we meditated. And now what that will do is, even if you do it just for a minute or two, you might find that you actually do recall more of what happened in the sittings, and you can value some of what you did. You can start to feel like you were able to get calm or settled because you noticed that that's what happened, or you were able to think more clearly about something, or that you may remember some images or stray thoughts that you had or stray sensations that you might have completely forgotten had you just gotten up and done something else. So this idea of using memory to create awareness is very important. And that's an important feature of this approach, because instead of trying to do this like in mindfulness practice, where you're going into the meditation sitting and you're trying to be aware of everything in the moment and staying mindful, staying attentive, here what is happening is you're allowing more things to develop into meditation, kind of letting things just flow on, and recollecting afterwards. And your recollection is actually making you more familiar with what you experience in meditation. So when you sit again, you find that actually your familiarity is helping you become more aware. So it's utilizing memory to help awareness instead of trying to create a kind of strong mindful awareness. Now, the thing is around a kind of mindful awareness or mindfulness is that it can make it so that you become aware of thoughts, or when you do become aware of thoughts, they stop. And that mindfulness practice often, as much as people may want to allow some of their thinking to go on, generally what happens is that you're becoming aware of thinking to have thinking end. And you're becoming aware of thinking in a way, perhaps not to notice it all that fully, maybe just to label it as a particular kind of thought, but not really to understand how your thinking works. So my belief is that you actually need to allow your thinking to go on and to recollect it to understand your thought processes, that you need to, in a sense, have thought processes to look into, to explore, and to become aware of. So the trick here is actually allowing yourself to think and also reflecting back at times on what you were thinking about and getting a sense of that. And sometimes what will happen with this awareness of thinking is that it gets really complicated for you, because you know you're going to be thinking a lot, reflecting back on it, thinking some more, reflecting back, and it may seem a bit too much if you try to do it that way. So really what I suggest is you just allow yourself to have the thoughts and go on thinking these things in meditation, and after the sitting, you recollect. You know, don't try to do it like a mindfulness practice. Just kind of be really gentle with yourself. Another side to this is that you may have noticed it in this particular sitting, at least some of you might have, that if you allow your thinking to go on, there's less conflict and tension around it, that you don't seem to be battling yourself as much or struggling with things. And so what starts to happen is that your thinking may actually die down on its own, or there may be a certain calm or peacefulness that's coming about just by the way you are with your thinking, that you're not, in a sense, creating some kind of situation where you either feel like you're failing because you're thinking, or you're critical because you're thinking, or you're not getting it right because you're thinking. Because here you are meditating in a way in which thinking is fine. It's not a problem. So that's a few important pieces. When we open up to thinking and emotions in our sitting, we also will open up to drifting off. And you might have also noticed that in your meditation sitting, that you probably got dozy, and that you found that this drifting off may actually be a way in which our minds naturally settle. And so to call it sleep or sleepiness and to try to wake yourself up, I think, is actually counterproductive. So actually, I would suggest that you allow yourself to drift, and that you might find that as you drift in meditation, you may not actually fall asleep. You may kind of skim the surface of sleep and come back up, and that you may find that another way for your mind to get more tranquil and relaxed instead of trying to fight it. So does it make actual sense, if you start getting relaxed to try to wake yourself up all the time? I don't think so. So you'll probably find that it may be actually more natural for you to do this. And if you do happen to fall asleep, well, it happens. It happens a lot in meditation, actually, even doing any practice. You just kind of start to get a sense of, well, what is sleep like when I'm meditating, and what, how can I really discern that from other states that seem like sleep? And that is going to be useful as you continue to meditate. So I'm going to actually open this up for questions at this point. I know it's daunting, all these people. Yes, please.
So the basic difference between choiceless awareness, where you allow your thoughts and feelings to come, is that in choiceless awareness, you are more or less observing it, whereas in what you're talking about, you're just letting it yourself go with it, yourself, not have to label it, observe it, but just go with it. Is that the difference?
One main difference. So I'm going to have to repeat your question for everybody. It's a very good question. She was saying that in choiceless awareness, as it's often taught, which is very similar to what I'm saying, is that you would most likely allow your thoughts to go on to a degree, but you're trying to be aware of it while they're going on. And you are kind of, in a place of letting your attention go from hearing, body, breath, thoughts, and you're letting your attention go around in choiceless awareness practice. In this kind of practice, instead, what we're actually doing is allowing the thinking to go on as we would normally, as we might normally do during the day. The difference here is that you're actually sitting and meditating, and that will change things. But I really do believe that adopting the meditation posture with the intention to meditate is going to change how you relate to your experience. And that's enough. You don't need to do anything more than that. And so you're going to find that your thinking is not going to be quite the same, quite exactly the same as you would if you were at home, ruminating, or, looking out the window, or driving on the highway, or something like that. That you might find that actually there's a capacity to kind of go around the thinking a bit and to notice some things as you continue to sit. The other main distinction between choiceless awareness and this approach is that, and you heard in my beginning instructions, choice is important here. It's not about, you know, just letting things go everywhere and just trying to surrender to whatever the movement of your mind is. It's actually how to develop skillful choices. Because I think that's really the heart of the Buddha's practice is, you know, the choices we make, the things, you know, how do we, in a sense, know our experience in ways, evaluate it, and look at actions that we're contemplating and make choices. And so here's an approach that, you know, you are, in a sense, responsible for the choices. In many meditation practices that you're given, you may find that actually they take away your choice. That if you do a practice of following the breath throughout the whole sitting, there isn't any choice there. You find that whatever thought, whatever feeling, whatever comes up, you bring your attention back to the breath. But here, in a sense, you have, you know, you don't know. Am I going to follow the sounds that I'm hearing? Am I going to stay with my experience in my body? Am I going to follow this thought process? And so what you find is you have certain points in your meditation sitting where you can make a choice. You can decide to do something or other. And some of those times you may find that it's just very easy to go in a certain direction. Like it might be, there might be a time where you're really aware of the breath. It's coming quite naturally and you just choose to focus a little bit more on it. And you find that you can stay with it much longer or in a much more satisfying way. And you find, well, that's a good choice, you know, at that time. And so that's a part of this kind of approach to meditation. If we're going to actually, in a sense, be responsible for our own path, our own direction meditation practice, we need to be able to get a sense of our inner world, what's coming up, and how to make choices as to where to put our attention. Because it's a shifting world. It's not going to be the same throughout the whole meditation sitting. Yes. Yeah, go right ahead.
When I'm drifting, or paying attention to what I recognize as like a hypnagogic state, you know, I've got so deep just coming and so on, I really love that place actually. I like it when I'm there. What I notice sometimes is that my mind sort of becomes unhinged from choices, if you like. I'm in a place where actually no, I'm not choosing anymore because I'm, you know, I'm just getting kind of disjointed.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's the thing. In those kinds of states, you know, your ability to direct things or move them along may be very limited. And so, yes, there are meditative states. There'll be times when it seems like it's impermeable. You can't get in to make a choice or steer things. But there is something that can start to happen in some of those states, like these hypnagogic states or the twilight, you know, between waking and sleep states, where if you see lights or images or things like that, you may find that you're drawn to them. And all you need to do is just allow yourself to be drawn to them, and you'll start to wake up a little bit more, and you'll start to find that the state will develop a bit more than if it just keeps going in this kind of random, scattered way. That tends to happen. Thank you. Yes.
How would you respond to the idea of this approach not encouraging a habit of the mind to proliferate and to? I guess what I've been taught about is. Mm-hmm. Is there any risk that if I allow my mind to roam
Okay. So this is a very good question too. So the question is basically, is that if you're allowing your mind to proliferate, to basically think of all sorts of things while you're meditating, are you doing something that's actually going to kind of encourage that activity? Is it going to like make it worse? And you could say the same thing with sitting and meditating and feeling a lot of, say, anger or will or certain desires, you know, coming up and letting them kind of, you know, burn and, you know, churn in you, you know, like letting them go on and on. Are you furthering that, or, you know, is something else happening? To be honest, I'd say you're doing a bit of both. But I do think that's our real situation with many things. It's not like, the idea here is that we're going to completely eliminate all desires or anger and everything within our meditation practice in this lifetime. I know you've been taught that, but I wouldn't go that far. But rather that we may come to a different way of relating to those experiences and change. That instead of trying to, say, get rid of our proliferation, our fantasies and desires and everything, in this kind of approach, it's really about, changing our relationship to those so that we can actually look into them, so that we're less dominated by them, we're less controlled, and we can understand how it works. We can understand, and I'll go into this more this afternoon, that they're dependently arisen, that there isn't a self in them or an other, that in a sense they come about through conditions. And that's what I believe the Buddha was actually trying to get at around practice, is that that the first hurdle we have to cross is not the hurdle of getting rid of desires or getting rid of certain kinds of views or ways of thinking, but to come to an understanding of dependent arising, of conditionality, by which we begin to really be able to see into the nature of our experience, and then desire and anger and various unwholesome states of mind will diminish. They'll become less dominant within our experience. The thing is that by allowing yourself to have fantasies and not just fantasies, people are, planning things, redecorating, doing gardening, doing all sorts of things while they're meditating. I mean, that's what we do. We think about all these different things that are going on in our lives, and we're probably doing a variety of, we have various projects and ideas going on. And instead of saying, well, that's something that should be outside of meditation, doesn't belong here, what I would suggest is let it in, because it's informing your future. It's kind of, it's thinking that is kind of going on and really has a place in your life. And if you don't let into meditation and start to look at it, how it works, how you're attached to it, how you're drawn into it, then it kind of lives in an unexamined place. It lives in a place where it just keeps popping up when you kind of don't want it, and you find that you're trying to get away from it by, coming back to the breath or changing to another object or something like that. But the same, kinds of plans, the same kinds of things keep coming up again and again and again. And I think that's really also what the Buddha was referring to around, samsara, around recurrence, that our minds are such that it keeps going around in cycles and bringing things up. So how are we going to actually break these cycles? It's not just simply by stopping it. I really do see it's by being with it in ways that we can start to examine it. And that brings me to another topic on this, is that I don't see us as being able to want to look into things like around our desires or ill will or our fantasies, mental proliferation, if we're not interested in it. If we are meditating and practicing in a way that's developing more distance from that, more, I would say, apathy around it, it means that we're kind of hoping for something else to happen. We're hoping for a moment of emptiness or awakening or some clear insight just to arise and to eliminate it all, instead of getting to know these, you know, sankhara, these, you know, formations, these, this patterning that we have, and really see how it works and dismantle it from within. Yes. No, whatever happens, you know. So if you end up, you know, like I said earlier, just even if you end up going to sleep, that's fine. Or you end up going deeply into a traumatic memory, or you, whatever starts to occur within the meditation sitting. Because, you know, to look at meditation as a, you know, safe, you know, environment, a safe container, to be able to go into whatever it is you are experiencing. To me, that would be, you know, to get there, to feel that you can be with difficult emotions and memories as well as very calm, tranquil, empty states. But this kind of approach is not about making that happen, but being attuned to when it happens of its own. And so that's part of the difference. A key element in this is receptivity. Many meditation practices actually are trying to generate or create experiences or get you to see things a certain way. This kind of approach, and I think open meditation practices in general, are about being receptive and allowing things to unfold and form of their own. And there's a distinction that I like to make between being passive and being receptive, which may help at times. That you may start off being passive in a sense, you know, your thoughts are just going on, you're passively, you know, going through them. But the direction is to become more receptive in a way that you're starting to listen to them. That's not just happening, but you're becoming a bit more aware that you're noticing things, that you're taking in what's going on. And that starts to change the way you are with some of the thoughts and the feelings. That if we just treat our thoughts, say, as clouds going across the sky, I think what happens is we start to become very passive around thoughts, and we don't notice their actual impact. We don't notice that we keep thinking about certain things, and then we find ourselves saying those things or doing them, and it seems like we're acting more unconsciously. Whereas if you start to be more receptive and you listen to your thoughts, you'll start to see, oh yeah, I keep having this recurring thought. No wonder these are the kinds of things I say. These are the kinds of things I do. And you start to get clued in a bit to how thoughts are actually affecting your speech and actions. Yes. Okay. With you know, being receptive and open to our thoughts, what's going to happen is we're going to find that we actually are resistant to having certain thoughts. There's quite a few kind of thoughts and feelings we, when they come up, we just don't want to go there. And so that's what you might have been experiencing, that you really didn't want to go there, but you were trying to allow yourself to go there, and so you're caught in this kind of struggle. So my suggestion around that generally is just to be kind of kind and gentle to the fact that you're resisting to yourself at that time. You don't have to really change much, except you may find that what's happened is that there's a certain dislike or harshness or aggression, something towards those thoughts. And so just be a little kinder, and you might find then that the repetition is actually saying something. That there may be something there to remember, to look at, or that you need to feel, you know, because we do need to kind of go through and process some feelings that we've had, and see what that's like during the sitting. You're welcome. This is going so well, I'm just waiting for the next question. Anyone? And much better than composing a talk. Yes?
I'm not very clear what the difference is between mindfulness meditation and this. I mean, are you supposed not to note or note over time?
No noting. No noting. And the thing with noting is that noting at first, like when you have a label for something, like say labeling something as planning, it may clue you in to that you're planning. It starts off with adding a certain discernment to your experience. But I believe after a while for many of us, what happens is it becomes automatic and it distances us from the experience. So the label starts to become something that's just kind of slapped on here and there, and we don't look at it anymore. We just kind of notice I'm planning and come back to the breath. So in this approach, what I'm actually saying is that instead of labeling, you let yourself have the thoughts and then you recollect afterwards and try not to use the labels in the recollection. And so instead of, say, writing down in your journal, you know, that you were planning, to actually say, you know, I was thinking about this sunny day and what I'm going to do afterwards and who I'm going to meet and what I'm going to, what I would like for lunch or something like that. So you go into more detail, more description. Because that's what you were actually thinking about. You weren't thinking about planning, you know. Planning is just like an interpretation. It's a secondary kind of label of things. So when you write down or you remember the more specific details of the thoughts, you're actually closer to your experience. And that's part of the direction of this whole approach, is so that we can become more discerning, more aware of what's going on, instead of, reducing experiences down to a few set terms. Well, that's going to happen. I mean, it's not necessarily the aim, but that will be part of it, you know, so that when you're obsessing about things, you'll find that, you know, first of all, you might notice how you are with the obsession. Are you, you know, fighting against it? Are you, you know, do you feel dominated by it, frustrated by it? And so you might notice the things around it, as well as the obsession, and find that you're, that your way of relating to it in meditation may start to shift over time. And then you may be able to look into the obsessions more, the obsessive kinds of thinking. Yes?
Well, coming on from that, when I was reading your book, I tried journaling and writing after each meditation session. I think about what you said right at the beginning today about what goes on in your mind and can't describe. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You know, because we do have a dilemma there, that we don't have adequate language to talk about our experience, and we apply the language we have, or the kinds of words that we use, we find that it doesn't really capture it, and it can deaden it, can feel like, well, I'm really not able to get at what was going on. So the way I look at it, and the way I've taught this for several years, is the writing down is actually, and the language we use is actually a tool to help us remember the experience. That as long as you kind of know that there is a difference between what you wrote down and what you recall as the experience, it's just like, you know, to use it not as, you know, the written words is what I experienced. No, it's just there to help me remember what went on during that time. And so you might find that that's enough, and that we actually need language as part of our the way our brain works to be self-reflective. You know, that if we don't have words, if we don't kind of put some language or some representation, some kind of image or something, we may not be able to reflect well enough on our experience to make it more explicit, to really kind of put it into memory and to know it over time. So to use it kind of as a tool rather than as the final statement about what went on. You know, and I've had, you know, discussions around this whole area, you know, that, you know, many times. And part of the thing is that there's this idea that meditative experiences may be beyond words. And so why put them into words if they're beyond words? And my sense of it is that that's true. Many experiences will never adequately fit into words. But if we try to describe, then we're kind of developing a capacity to notice more more succinctly, you know, more carefully what is going on in our experience. So really to consider that. So if you've had experiences that you think are, or you felt, well, I could never talk about this. You know, I can't talk about this spaciousness or this emptiness or this deep tranquil state I go into. Try writing down some small words, you know. You might find that there's some subtleties there that you might notice, remember that this very tranquil state also had this feeling of contentment in it, you know, or it felt, it has a certain kind of color or vibration to it. And just to write down those elements will help you become a bit more aware when you go back into those states. Yes. No, that's a hard one to say. Well, how did it go for you?
This last one?
Yeah.
It was good. It wasn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. It wasn't battling so much. I let the voices come and wasn't in so much conflict, which was quite a relief.
Good. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, if this had a good effect and it reduced the conflict you had with it, then you know, I would continue for a while. You know, the thing is with this kind of approach is that you can always stop. You know, you can always decide, okay, I'm sitting with a lot of thoughts, it's overwhelming, I need a break from this, and just do something else. So if you feel confident, you know, that you could, you know, discern that, pick that out, and monitor, then continue. I mean, I developed the approach, you know, from a Buddhist point of view as a monk, and you know, from that orientation, you know, but of course, over the years, I've done a lot of reading and study, and I trained as a psychotherapist for a while. So, I mean, it has those elements in it, but I think those elements are also part of how we're, our westernization of meditation practice. I don't know, as a Westerner, we can actually go into it and look at it if we're not willing to kind of also consider the research and consider what you know, what's going on with people who are doing these kinds of practices. So yes, it's there. But I also have my own theories around meditative process that I write about, and that are more related to Dharma direction rather than, you know, psychotherapy. But let me just say one last thing about this too, is that the mind in meditation, the mind in psychotherapy are not really that much different, you know. So I think the division was really artificially created, you know, many years ago. And that the thing is that many of the meditation practices that were originally brought to the West, they didn't necessarily have this, weren't operating from the same kind of psychology, and they didn't have this way of people really going into their thoughts and talking about their experiences in great detail with the teacher. And so that's one of the differences in this approach from the beginning. Yes.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to explain how I've been taught to work with thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that fits with what you're saying. So, coming from a mindfulness background where thoughts are one object to look at, that's something that's not, you're not supposed to get rid of them, it's something interesting to look at. What I find is I often get really sucked into them, and after a while I'm not even aware that I'm thinking. I'm in that, and I get very far away until I kind of realise, oh, it's gone. And that can be due to several things. It can be that there is a recurring pattern. It's really interesting to just become aware of that and see, you know, where is that coming from? Is there an emotion? What's going on? But sometimes I find it feel it's almost like just not wanting to be there. Like I'd rather entertain myself with these thoughts. And I don't think that's awareness. I mean, I'm trying to see where being in that type of thinking would still be within the realm of awareness.
Okay, very good question. See, that's part of this whole thing, the whole dilemma of looking at thoughts. You know, how do you, if you're caught up in the thoughts, if you're completely embedded in thinking about something, how is that awareness? How are you developing awareness? And I would say the truth is that at that time, you're probably not developing awareness. But you can recollect it when you come out of it and develop awareness after the fact, and then find that the process of recollecting it and noticing it makes it so that you may have a little bit more awareness over time as you go back into those thoughts. And that's what this approach is about. It's a kind of, it's subtler, you know, that you're trusting that that you're going to come out of that kind of train of thought, the recurrent train of thought, and instead of just going to the breath or something and moving on with your meditation, to take a moment and reflect back, perhaps, or reflect back at some point and get a sense of what was going on, and then, you know, you move on, and you find when you go back into those kinds of thoughts, within a few seconds you might get clued in. This is what I'm thinking again. This is what attracts me here. This is what I'm. This is how the thought kind of holds together for me, and also maybe where it fits. You might find that sometimes what we can't tell is that our thinking didn't originate, you know, the moment we thought it did. You know, like, you know, it didn't originate when you suddenly had this idea and you started thinking about it. It was actually far in the past, and that it may have other connections that you just can't see. And so that's the thing about it, is that our thought processes may actually be, you know, when you're looking at something like dependent arising, you know, where did they come from? You know, Some of it is that, some of the feeling is that it's just, you know, it's either just going on and on and on, you know, kind of like under the surface, or, you know, there's a particular trigger, I start thinking, and that's it, I'm gone. Instead of realizing, no, there may be just a way in which certain thoughts are, like, I think you mentioned this, you know, they might, some might be kind of soothing thoughts, some may be thoughts that you've kept entertaining because they orient you, or they, some thoughts or some kinds of thinking may be types of thinking that help take you away from things that are painful. You know, and so you start to notice that's how that thinking works. Yes?
But the I struggle with is getting some sort of structure in time, considering now when doing it regularly. Though I value what I do, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts. You suggested half an hour, right? What sort of pattern promotes?
My experience has been, it depends where people are in their meditation practice, that if you're meditating, say, for half an hour and you find that you keep getting really restless and antsy, you know, for the last 5 or 10 minutes, then maybe go down to 20 minutes, you know, and really just kind of look at, well, this is what I can handle, and it's no failure, no problem. But if it feels like you're getting calm and settled and you can actually go longer, then go longer and just kind of get a sense of where you are with that as far as the length of time. And the other thing I'd say is that, we think it helps us to have a set time to meditate every day. And I know, you know, many of us are time starved, but to basically, you know, sit at times also that are different, and to sit after, you know, maybe something unpleasant has happened, or you're feeling upset, or even, you know, that you want to sit, you want to look at something, to kind of choose your times as well, and to see what it's like meditating then.